There was some question about your successor, and didn't you had someone leave the company at one point?
We looked around and hired a headhunter fellow, and we got a one of the vice presidents of Grace named Claybo that was here about a year, and I think it was only a year, maybe two, and he was not it's a lousy thing to say, I guess, but a melancholy kind of guy. He was more of a flamboyant what the hell was his favorite expression? Rather than prepare a hell of a presentation for financial analysts, he would, what the hell was his expression, not off the cuff, but he would go to a meeting, I guess he would tell me one or two and do this, and would say things that were sounded good, but if somebody started to grill him, he'd lose face. And then he seemed to want to, and I don't know, this is probably my doing, he wanted to come in and had nothing to do with anybody historically at Mallinckrodt, like me or this financial fellow. He wanted to take over everything from the day one himself, and I guess that was a subjective reaction on my part, that was a lousy way to run a transition. And so then we wound up with Bentelli, the fellow who was the Brenner's assistant, or Brenner's second in command. And then when Mallinckrodt got sold to Avon, the first mistake they got made was Avon paid too much money for Mallinckrodt. And they just, the head guy came out here after the purchase and gave a talk to the Mallinckrodt employees and said, "You people got a wonderful record, and we don't know anything about the chemical and the pharmaceutical business, and we don't plan to learn. And you guys just carry on, it'll be great." Well, that's a fool's talk. And if I pay $20 for something, I'd want to know what's going on, $770 million. And then a fellow became chairman of the board of Avon, and I've forgotten his name. I never knew him very well, although he used to sit right across from me. I was a director of Avon for 12 or 15 months. And he was not a good guy there either. He didn't stay long. But anyway, he damn near wrecked Mallinckrodt in the process and was planning to sell off pieces of it because that was a fashion at the time, maybe mm-hmm. in the early 80s. And Bentelli did a great job on the board there, at least keeping Mallinckrodt from getting sold piecemeal and having it sold as a unit. And then it was bought by IM&C in Chicago. A fellow named Kennedy was running IM&C. You're familiar with this, I guess.
But earlier, before Avon, there was National Distillers made a move. And you told the stockholders that you wanted to continue the independence of the company. I have a quote here somewhere. You argued that survival as an independent entity depended on its future... that was earlier. But you did want to maintain the company's independence rather than a hostile takeover.
I don't know how much of a... There were some... I think, as my recollection is, that some other companies had shown some interest in it. This guy from National Distillers, I thought, had a lot of nerve. He bought... It seemed like a lot of money in those days. It doesn't sound like much now. It couldn't have been $25 million. Maybe it was $5 million worth of, I don't know. And he came out here and talked to us, and nothing came of that, but he made a lot of money on the stock that he bought selling Mallinckrodt to Avon, I believe, was a damn good thing for the stockholders. I'm not sure it was, I don't know who got hurt in the deal, except Avon. But there was no doubt of it being a good thing for the stockholders. If it hadn't been sold, I assume that somebody would have found a way to take it over. And I think that as things have turned out, which certainly weren't planned, it's a better situation than if somebody had come in and taken it over, but who the hell knows?
Was Benatil doing involved with the takeover, or were you playing a role in that?
He and I were doing it. And there were lots of things involved. The company had to be run in the meantime when it was being taken over, or talks were going on, and those had to be handled. And then there was lawyers that got into the deal, and then we sort of parceled out the different activities, and I was on a board of Avon for 12 or 15 months after they bought it, and I guess he was on it until I got sold to Kennedy to IMNC. That guy had a lot of nerve at IMNC. You familiar with that?
I know just a little bit about it.
He was in this commodity business at IMNC, fertilizers for the agricultural world. And that's not a very spectacular business. And he had the guts to buy this thing from Avon by borrowing a lot of money and selling half of IMC, I think, first, and since then, and fairly recently, within the last couple of years, I guess, all of IMC has been sold to the public, and now IMC was all the profits came from Mallinckrodt. So the fellows like Ray Holman, who's now chairman of the board, changed the name back to Mallinckrodt and moved it to St. Louis, which is a nice thing for the community and for the people.
You in your 40th anniversary with Mallinckrodt in 1979, and I was going to ask you if we might be able to get a copy of this. Each guest received a pamphlet titled "A Short Chronicle of Your Contributions to Mallinckrodt." And if somewhere along the line we might be able to get a copy of that, it would be appreciated.
Okay, I saw one of those the other day.
But I'm now quoting, "In less than two decades, Thayer had rekindled in Mallinckrodt the spirit of determination, persistence, and performance that characterized the company in its earlier days. His cultural revolution has succeeded." I was intrigued by that comment. "And you had preserved and enhanced Mallinckrodt's values of quality, integrity, and innovation."
Sounds great. Who said that?
It's in the company history. 125th history.
You know the fellow who ran that? That's called
the History Factory?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know anything about it.
God, what an eager beaver he is. Let me see. If you want one of those, I'll... I'll find one. Have you got a card here that I can keep, so I can keep track of the...
Sure, what I did with it.
Yeah. How is this organization run, on by contributions of people or by a regular of the chemical industries?
It's a combination of contributions from individuals. We have industrial support, number of companies and foundation support, American Chemical Society, AICAG, and grants for special projects from, we had Mellon Foundation money for a project, Pew Foundation money. This project being supported by the contributions from the Society of Chemical Industry.
Was your talk of Monsanto, did he mention Hochwald and these things?
No, we didn't talk about Hochwald at all.
Now, they had another product there, an agricultural product that's great.
Lasso.
Yeah.
Yes. Let me just finish up with a few things. We've covered most of my original agenda, but one of the things I noticed when you gave your talk, when you received the chemistry industry medal, was that you focused on the government regulation. What changes have you seen since that time?
Well, I was bitching. But good God, it's increased so much since then. I don't know. It's awful hard to know what's right and wrong. But I heard a discussion on television a week ago Sunday, I think. Five governors of five states that had tried a lot of original ways to cut down their budgets and do good things with welfare and one thing and another, and they've been very successful, I guess, and maybe that's why they got elected again. Just thought it was awful what the federal government does to the states, and I guess the same story can be made for what federal government does to the EPA rules and to anything else they tamper with, which is most everything. And these are very complicated subjects, so when you talk about education, for example, it seems like to me that you've got to have somebody, some group, looking at all the citizens. Now, they can't run every school board in every state, but it seems like to me they can't leave it up to the citizens of Nebraska to teach only how to raise wheat. And the requirements of the states are so different that if you don't have something imposed on them to teach them how to read and write, that's bad. This is taking an absurd extremity here. But when they get too tight, that's bad. And I don't know what too tight really is, but to hear these governors talk, there's no doubt about it that at least when I heard it, I guess it's all true, that they were much able to do better with less money on the subjects that they were talking about, one of which was welfare, than the federal government does. And geez, you get the first thing that happens when a new law gets passed, I facetiously say, up goes a new 20-story building in Washington to run it. And Washington's got to have some control out of the country this big and this complicated, I think. Or else you have so much difference of opinion of what's good for Arizona and what's good for the people of Rhode Island. But you can't go too far with it, or you get 24-story buildings and no action. But the education is, good God, my favorite semi-facetious remark is, they teach basket weaving instead of reading and writing. And this, I don't know, it just seems awful to him, but I suppose the guy that started that figured it was great, and he sold it to a lot of people. You must have pretty good feelings on this subject, having gotten a PhD.
Yes.
What was your PhD in?
Chemistry.
Geez, that's a pretty disciplined, highly disciplined field.
Mm-hmm. I had a question and I lost it. In terms of, I know what it was. Bill Wishnick of Whitco Chemical told me that his father, who founded the company, who came in to do something in the office till the day he died in his late 80s, in his later years complained to his son. He said, "You've got all these lawyers and all these environmental people." He said, "They're not selling anything. They're non-productive people in terms of the product of the company, all brought on by government regulation." Was that true also with Mallinckrodt? Did you have to bring in?
Sure. Of course, that was when I was more closely involved with that in the middle 70s. It was just a mild dose of what's going on now. One of the things that always amazed me was that a guy, remember they used to have quotas for something, people, I guess. It couldn't have been, it was back in the days when you could keep track of whether a fellow was black or white, and they would set quotas up. And a guy that was a perfectly normal person would be representing the government, and all of a sudden he would be a philosophical picture. A correct, bright philosophical picture of what the government wanted and pushed the hell out of you. And I always wondered how he got so many converts. Well, maybe they weren't converts, it was just a job and that's what they did.
Yeah, many of them are very, it's almost a religious fervor with them, so yep. The way they do that.
The airlines have gotten into a pickle on the other side of the subject, it looks like to me.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know what was good for themselves. Where's this fellow who did that? He's a professor at Harvard now, is he? The fellow who masterminded the deregulation of the airlines?
Yes, I don't know where he's at.
But awful abuses go on, too. Jesus, this guy, not Miller, Milken?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the bastard's got $600 million left, I guess, now, after spending a year and a half in jail, and he must have screwed a lot of people. These seem awful things to me.
Yes, you wonder why the people who were... there can't be some kind of retribution after...
Yeah.
Let me ask you one more question. We've been talking about innovation, research and development in some respects throughout the afternoon. What do you think is important for the future of chemical innovation, research and development?
I mean, it's a dumb thing to say, but bright people. But there's so many things, I wonder, I don't know. It looks like to me as though there's so much decompartmentalization of knowledge now. Some guy gets to be an authority on some little piece of chemistry, and another guy over here. How do you keep these things together? This must be an important thing to help answer your query. How do people knit together all the things that are useful to them to studying a particular problem? This is tough. I would think it would be awful tough. And how you, I guess what you're really talking about, and they give courses in school, don't they, on the subject of how to stimulate imagination and I guess there's no answer to this, is there?
Well, there's no easy solution, obviously. But
I guess with people that have this ability to imagine and create, ought to be left alone.
Okay.
And nobody should tamper with them or they'll screw them up.
Okay.
That's Bill Danforth's definition. Let them do their thing.
And what? This is a standard question I'm asking of everyone. What did it mean to you when you won the SCI medal from the Society of Chemical Industry?
Well, of course, I was proud as hell.
Okay.
I wonder what else I can say that's meaningful. You become part of a kind of eliteness that is very satisfying. What's your normal answer?
Most people said it hasn't meant anything. And which is a surprising answer. I never expected that answer. And you and John France on the other day, the first two people who felt differently than that. So,
well, the people that give you those answers got a string of 30 medals, maybe they've won?
Some have others.
Oh, maybe that's...
John made the point that for a researcher, a person who spent his entire career doing research rather than moving into administrative responsibilities, there are very few rewards and recognitions. And so when they come from your peers as the Perkin Medal or the SCI Medal, then that has considerable meaning.
Yeah, it must be true what you just said, though, because unless a guy gets a Nobel Prize, these scientific things are talked about in the newspapers all so often that it's got to be really something. And a patent never gets any publicity. And then also I think that things are getting so complicated. We read about the Genome Project and about the biochemical business and Amgen coming along and Genentech. Mm-hmm. And they're all such complicated things just in themselves that it's hard to understand what they may mean. So if a scientist is involved in any one of those things, it's such a big job, a big scope of activity, that it's hard to get any recognition for it. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's the trouble.
Well, is there anything else you would like to add that I haven't covered?
I don't think so. I think that you must have done a lot of homework before you got here.
Well, I did a little bit.
I'm reminded of a number of things because of it that I never would have thought of. I don't think of it as anything.
Okay. Well, when you see the transcript, if there's anything else you might want to add.
Probably amount to a lot of pages, but a lot of stuff that are O's and I's, huh?
Now, I appreciate your time very much. Thank you for spending the afternoon with me.
It's been very nice to somebody who's covered the scope of things.
And that's going to come very fast.
When I first came out here, it was 50 years ago, the country was probably only 125 million people, wasn't it? And in front of our eyes, it's doubled.
I remember we said we wouldn't hit 200 million until the turn of the century.
And now we're 225 or something, 250.
I have one other brief matter here. We have a standard release form. Which is self-explanatory.
What does it say?
Well, basically it says that you certify that you've been interviewed, that we will transcribe this and make it available to you, and then you will have the opportunity to request restrictions on access and so on. And
when does this happen, do you suppose?
When you get the transcript?
I mean, I do that to the 2 weeks or 2 years or?
Well, I'm hoping it will be within a couple months.
How many of these do you want at the same time?
Well, this series of interviews is going to be about 40 interviews. So it's quite a project. You're number 7, I think. So
where else would it be?
Oh. Thank you very much. And if I said, I appreciate you spending the time with me today.
Yeah, you know, I think there'd be a common thread of something that runs through them.
That's what I'm looking for. And
I don't know whether it's the characteristics of the situation or the people or the industry or geography or philosophy or what.
I think a lot of it, from what I've seen so far, a lot of it is individual personality that makes something like this up.
And that has to fit at the time, I
think. That's right. It has to.
So you've got to lose it.
That's right.
Like this business of a manager's a manager.
When I was chairman of our chemistry department and looking for people to hire, interviewing people, we had a department of 6 or 7 people in a liberal arts setting. And one of the things I always looked for was how they would fit with the rest of the department. They could have had brilliant chemistry, but if I didn't feel they were going to fit properly with the rest of the people in the department, it was not going to be a good situation. And they might have fit perfectly in another situation. I wanted to fit with ours because you didn't need somebody to come in and be divisive or upsetting, and you wanted them to contribute. And I'm not saying they had to fit the mold, but I've seen situations where people come in and can destroy the organization rather than help build it. And some of that, another thing that's showing up is that people talk about having an intuition, a gut feeling. I've heard that term several times with me, that they've used in making decisions, which turned out to be very good ones.
Well, I suppose this happens to everybody in all situations. Somebody uses a gut, and maybe it's a spectacular kind of thing. But in most decisions that people make, just where they turn on the street, they're almost automatic. Mm-hmm. When you get it, I would think that, well, the gut is a good word. It sounds spectacular. But most people, I think, analyze the hell out of important subjects as best they can, and maybe finally it looks so balanced that somebody has to decide something. But it's nice to feel at least the fact of what I do. It's not a crafty.
No, it's more than that, but let's say there's a chemical intuition someone has. That a project is going to succeed even though at the moment it doesn't look that promising. There's a very famous story at Dow Chemical when they were working on styrene development in the 30s. And Lord Dow decided that the plastic they were going to work on would be cellulosic plastic rather than styrene plastic. And he gave the order to stop working on styrene. One of the people on the project went to the company controller and he said, I know this is going to work, we just need a little more time. And the controller said, I have my orders, I have to close the account. But what you do is give me another name and I'll open a new account in the other name. And Lord Dow never knew.
And of course, they went on to become the leader in firing technology.
Hey, what's happened to that company anyway? It used to be the creator, a world builder, and what happened to it anymore?